Good morning. My name is Chris Raymer. I'm a recovered alcoholic. It's good to see you guys here. I didn't figure anybody would be here on Sunday morning. In the States, you know, everybody comes Saturday night and they sleep Sunday morning. Nobody, you know, but a few diehards. We're in a country of diehards, aren't we? This is great. I got to tell you, I have enjoyed this weekend. Still no sleep, but what the heck, you know? I've enjoyed this weekend. I got to thank our hosts. There have been so many people that have carted us around and taken us places, and wonderful hospitality. I'm sure every speaker y'all ever heard has said the same thing. Thank you for your we're talking about it this morning. We're pretty well blown away by y'all's kindness. It was so great to see all our buddies from England that we've met before, and the little knuckleheads from Iceland. You know, it was great to... Always good to see those psycho buckaroos. We're absolutely honored to have had the chance to come over here and see this. We were laughing about it yesterday, walking through downtown. You know, everybody's so kind. I mean, and it sounds like I'm patronizing you, but it's just, you know, nobody's honking horns. Nobody, you know, you get out in New York or any of the big cities, you know, and you slow down for a minute to look at something. You've got six people pushing you over, you know, and it's like, get out of my way, you know, throwing fingers, honking horns. It's just standard procedure. And they even do it in Texas. You know, I mean, it's fast. But when here, everything, you know, even the revolving doors are slow. You know, it's just, I'll get run over. We get back into Chicago at the airport. We'll be de-acclimated. We'll have to re-acclimate ourselves to the stupid states. And so, I don't know. I'm speechless about this place. I'll be thinking about you guys for the rest of our lives. That's the truth. As always, before I get a chance to speak, I need to kind of tell you a little bit where I'm coming from. A lot of y'all have heard CDs of mine. Y'all have heard tapes of mine. And I am evil, and it's funny how many of you said, you're not quite what I thought you would look like. I'm not sure what y'all thought I would look like, but you're not what I thought you would look like either, you know? So, there you go. But the CDs are cool, the tapes, you know, the message gets to travel around, but a lot of times people will get these CDs and the introduction's cut off in the front, and they just get a piece of it, and they hear me ranting and raving, and I think, God, this guy's just angry. He's just pissed off, you know? He's just... You know, I don't know, very rigid, you know, and they don't understand where I'm coming from. And so I want to make sure that, at least here, that you guys understand where I'm coming from. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love our sister fellowships. I love the 12 steps, and I'm alive today because of that. And there you go. And I'm alive today because of that, because of people like you and people that cared enough about me to tell me the truth. And I feel like I have a responsibility to carry that message on. So, you know, it's like I'm not near as a polished speaker as Myers and Alicia. I wish I was. I wish I could just come up here and tell my little story and go home. But you see, my story involves AA abuse. You know, my story involves some controversy. And as always, when I speak from the podium, I need to tell you, my story may be different than your story. You might have come to this fellowship, sit in open discussion meetings, listen to people talk about their problems endlessly. You may just love to hear those war stories, and you may be sober 40 years. I'm so happy for you. I'm tickled to death. That's not my experience. We got to share with a bunch of y'all yesterday in our workshops. You know, one of the big problems that we have in the country, one of the big problems, I'll say this, in Alcoholics Anonymous, period, is that we have a preponderance of open discussion meetings where people can talk about anything they want. And they do talk about anything they want. They talk about everything except the message we're supposed to talk about. And I feel real strongly about that we are heading towards the cliff, which there's no return. unless we reel this back in. And I'm going to say it again, because your experience may not be the same as mine. You may love those meetings. You may find what I'm saying offensive. And I apologize going in the door. I'm not trying to be offensive. I'm trying to share my experience. And I can't change my experience. I could come up with a new story, maybe. I was a mercenary down in South America, and no, that's horseshit. That's not true. You know, I was a cook in the hill country. You know, I was raised down in the hill country, and we started drinking in high school, just like everybody else, keg beer, you know, and it just was, I was kind of a late bloomer. I was about 17 years old when I first started to drink, and thank God there was alcohol for me, because I was always a little uncomfortable in my own skin. Y'all see me out there smoking, you know, they say, Chris, you just seem so distant. That's me. I'm the shyest person in this room. That's a fact. Until I do this. 5 seconds after I get off this podium, I'll go back to being a shy person. That's just... Y'all don't believe that. I hope that girl that's pouring coffee believes that, though. That's kind of sexy. I tell you... Danish women. Myers comes across as Mr. Spiritual. You know, today I look at no other women. I do. I'm happily married. I love her to death. Danish women. I'm going to get Patty to change her name to Olga or something. That's German, isn't it? What the? Always uncomfortable in my skin. And when I started drinking, everything started feeling a little bit better. We were talking to some of the cats earlier today. A lot of y'all have had the same experience with me. And I think in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have this misunderstanding that AA is about just about not drinking. You know, our sister fellowship, Cocaine Anonymous, just don't do the cocaine. And that, guys, that's not what this is about. That's what we're led to believe. One day at a time, you can stay sober. It's great. But if that's all you do is one day at a time, not drink, and you think your life is going to get better, you are in for a rude awakening. If you're new in this room and you think that that's the problem, you've got to read this book and understand what the problem is. My problem is not drinking. My problem is alcoholism. It's a disease, fatal, progressive, it's genetic. Unless it's treated, my mind will take me back to the drink. Or, if I'm in a position where I've got some sobriety under my belt, some dry time, it may take me to the end of a gun. Because I can't live not drinking. I must have the spiritual experience so that I can get comfortable in my own skin. Y'all with me? We've talked about this a lot this weekend, and it's still so controversial because I hear people in meetings all the time say, if you just don't drink, you've had a successful day. But, just, you know, all of us have proved that in sobriety. We've done crazy things. We're goofy. We can't. It's not working for us. You know, we're not happy. I mean, guys, this is about being happy. There's a line in the book that says, it's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker to be able to control and enjoy his drinking. This is all about being able to enjoy life. And if you're sitting in these rooms and you're miserable, you're missing what this is all about. But if you're just not drinking, you're going to be miserable. This got to be more. In my experience, I was in the food business. I was a professional chef for about 15 years. While I'm thinking about it, I want to thank the cooks, my little buddy that cooked the food. Gosh, it was wonderful. I don't know what some of y'all have been eating the last couple of days, but we've been dining like kings. Bless them for doing all that hard work. But that's what I did for a living. I was a cook, and it wasn't because I was a particularly good cook, but I was fast. You know, I was pretty quick. And we were living better chemically. You know, I discovered early on a thing called methamphetamine, and alcohol was a pretty good combination. And you could work a lot and, you know, don't need any sleep. And so But I was never really very happy doing that. I enjoyed the business, but I was crazy and not a happy camper inside. And I started early on moving. A lot of us in Texas, we move around a lot. And you can move forever and not even, I mean, in Texas, a big place. But I moved to Houston right after high school, and then I moved to Austin, Texas, our capital there, and then I moved to Atlanta, Georgia, then I moved to Dallas, then I moved back to Houston, then I moved to Kerrville, then I moved to a little town called Vernon, Texas. Y'all with me? It's like some of y'all, you move a lot. Back and forth between Iceland and Denmark, I understand, is a good cure for alcoholism, you know? Just like, it didn't work. And but damn it, you know, I get there and guess who's there? You know, me. And it's in my head. And I'm believing, as we talked about yesterday, that if I could just change a few things in my life, everything would be okay. You know, the spiritual malady that the book talks about is on me. At 17, it was on me. You know, irritable, restless, discontent, depression, boredom, no sense of direction. Go with us? I mean, this feeling of uselessness. You know, that we talk a lot about codependency in our fellowships. You know, the book talks about this constant need of others' approval. And that's me. See, I hate myself. I don't like who I am. I'm not good enough looking. Nothing's good enough. No matter how much money I'm making, it's not good enough. And I spent 20 years drinking and drugging, trying to organize my outside life so I could finally get okay in here. You know, God, if I could just get out of this stupid kitchen and get up to that other kitchen, everything would be okay. If I could just buy that little barbecue restaurant, everything would be okay. You know, if I could just get the catering company, you know what I'm saying? Instead of be drinking, you know? If I could just get in sales, you know, salesmen, they don't drink. I'd get me a white shirt and a little chicken clip on tie, you know, and I'd be a little salesman, have a little briefcase. I'd be sitting out by the lake reading the one ads with a 12-pack of beer on the floor of my truck, you know, because I've got to drink. I've got to treat this internal condition. The only time I feel normal is when I've got alcohol in my body. Normal drinkers and druggers, people out there, your family members, they don't understand this. They think what we're doing is just partying too damn much. I mean, it's like there was a time when it appeared that that was the case. But guys, this stopped being a party for me a long time ago. You know, one day I had it, and the next day it had me. And now it's telling me what to do. And it's a terrible place to be. They don't understand that. See, when I'm drinking, I'm okay inside, comfortable. I've said this from a podium. I offended somebody one time by doing it. I'm going to say it again. When alcohol and drugs was working for me, I was a better person because of it. And I think all of you guys can agree with that. Isn't that the truth? I remember in the late 70s, you know, it was the disco era in the United States. I don't know if disco ever hit Denmark, but, you know, God, let's hope not. But, you know, we'd go to the discotheques, and I'd have a couple of drinks, you know, and I'd catch myself in the mirror and have to take a double take. It was just like John Travolta was there, you know. I'd get out on the dance floor and with alcohol, I could do a lot of that stuff. I could balance my checkbook. I could ask you for a date. I could go get a job. But without alcohol, I couldn't wash clothes. I couldn't go get groceries. I couldn't do anything. Make sense? It doesn't to most people. They, I know, busted. I know. About 1980, I've spent some years in therapy trying to organize my little life, trying to help, and I've benefited from a lot of that therapy. I know we have some therapists in the audience, and I got to tell you, therapy is wonderful. And if you're new in recovery, old in recovery, and you've got a few extra shekels to throw away, therapy is great. Therapy is great. But I spent a lot of time trying to figure out why I was, because that was big in the States. There's got to be a reason that you can't stop drinking. You with us? Low self-esteem, that's it. So we'd go to therapy and they'd give us lists of positive affirmations, and I would read the positive affirmations every morning and look at myself. You know, it's like, you know, I'm a beautiful child of God. I I tell you, if in therapy or in treatment, if that's the best we can come up with is positive affirmations, we are so screwed. You know what I'm saying? I gotta say it. It's like me standing naked in front of the mirror. I do have a big dick. I do have a big dick. I hope that coffee girl didn't hear that. Anyway. You want to feel good about yourself? I'm going to tell you something. The coolest thing in the world, if you want to raise your self-esteem about 400 notches, sit down across the table from some little busted up drunk sometime and share your experience, strength, and hope with him and watch that little sparkle, that little hope get into his eyes and says, you mean I can wake up sometime in the next few days and the obsession to drink will be gone, and watch that look on his face? Buddy, you'll walk out thinking you just saved the world. You'll feel better than you ever could. Anyway, I got a Reader's Digest condense this because it's a couple things I want to share with you besides positive affirmations. I ended up in Houston. I was living with my brother, if I remember correctly. I spent a lot of time living with Myers. Thank God for family. You know, I can make a car payment, but I can't make a car payment and an apartment, you know, so you kind of double up. And I have the ability to earn a lot of money, but I'm not. I'm drinking and spending it on drugs and stuff. So there's a woman in there I met in a bar, and she was working at a bar where Myers used to tend bar. I thought it was his best customer, and I would come in and visit, and I fell in love with this little girl, and she was a nice egg. And I remember going out to the parking lot. There, y'all know, ever hear the Astrodome? You know, this is kind of in the shadow of the Astrodome in Houston, Texas. And I remember thinking, God, if you could let this girl marry me, everything's going to be great, you know, because I'm pushing 30 years old. It's time for me to grow up, settle down, you know, maybe have kids, do something stupid like that. And thank God I didn't. And I asked this girl to marry me eventually, a few weeks later, and she said yes, and I mean, short, boom, 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 you know, we're married. And it's one of those deals, you know, I'm sitting at a little garage apartment where I live there, and she's maybe 2-3 weeks married, watching her eat, shovel those Cheerios in her mouth, and I'm saying, God, if you could just kill this woman, everything would be okay, you know? I'm back into therapy trying to figure out what was it? You're talking about everything under the sun, mom, dad, you know. Tell us about your childhood. Every therapist says, tell us about your childhood. Just unbelievable. How were you potty trained? What position did you sleep at night? Where were you born? All this. We talked a lot about Vietnam, you know. We talked a lot about the traffic. I'd never been to Vietnam, but we talked a lot about Vietnam. I got to tell you, we were talking to my buddies in England about this when I was over there at a CA deal. You know, we spent a lot of time, every therapist I ever talked to, we spent a lot of time talking about my sexuality. Because, you know, a lot of us have hang-ups around sex, a lot of problems around there. And she seemed to believe that if I could finally get clear around my sexuality, that I could break free of this shame and guilt that's perpetuating my alcoholism. I wanted to be gay. I mean, I thought this would be a good thing, you know. Then I could blame it on something, you know. But I'm not, and it's like. Can y'all get to see where I'm going? So many of us have grasped at straws. What is it that's causing me to drink? Is it being gay? Is it being black? Is it being abused? Is it being the traffic? Is it the job? Is it the poverty? Is it mom? Is it dad? Is it something? But see, nobody's ever going to tell us that it's a disease. Genetically, we were born with it. Nobody with diabetes sits around and says, gosh, how did I get this terrible disease? I mean, what caused it? You know, nobody talks about that. They were born with it. It's genetic. It's like being allergic to a food. It's no more complicated than that. If you have it, your body will not metabolize alcohol like normal people. It's just this simple. I have a physical allergy. I can't control it when I put it in my body. Simple. Coupled with a mental obsession. I can't stop when I want to stop. Y'all down with that? That's alcoholism. And if you can relate to that, it doesn't have anything to do with my drama. Can my drama exacerbate the problem? Can my drama make it worse? Yes, of course it can. That's why some good therapy is great. That's why working these steps, finishing a stupid fourth step, making those amends, cleaning up the wreckage of your past will help you walk into some free air. But my drama does not cause the disease. Two years married to this woman. We're living in Denton, Texas, and we have a little domestic disturbance. And I promised this woman that I would never take another drink. And and 2 weeks later, I drank. And she was not a happy camper. And she packed her stuff and moved back to Houston. And I think I moved back in with Myers. And I'm... But what it did for me, it put me into the system there. And MHMR got hold of me, this mental health mental health and mental retardation, something. It's in the mental health services with alcohol. And so I ended up at another therapist's couch. But this one was a licensed chemical dependency counselor. And this cat knew about alcoholism. And he's looking at me and looking at my chart, you know, and looking at all this stuff. And I'm taking handfuls of antidepressants. And he's saying, Chris, buddy, I don't know about this manic depressive stuff. I'm not real sure about your bipolar and this anxiety. I'm not sure. But I can tell you by looking at this, you're a drunk. He says, you're an alcoholic. And I was pissed. You know, I mean, I don't mind being crazy, but I don't want to be a drunk. You know, we got standards. And so, she said, you need to get your butt to an AA meeting. And so I said I would, and I did. And I went to my first AA meeting. And I'm watching the clock because I don't want to get too long with this, but... I remember my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It was in downtown Denton, Texas. And I checked the address, and there's a little sign outside, and I walk and look, and it's pitch dark outside, and it's dark up these steps, these big steps. And no, it wasn't 12 steps. I don't remember how many. It was just old, it was an old, dirty, damn warehouse is what it was. And we walked up these creaky steps, and in this room, there was one little light bulb hanging down on a lamp. And back over in the corner, there was this old geezer. Old geezer leaning back in an easy chair. I didn't know if he was dead or not. And my eyes get adjusted. It's like my Fraley's, you know, in Houston. You know, your eyes get adjusted. And I'm looking, and there's three other people in the room, too. There's three other ladies in there, and me. You know, and he says, do you have a problem with alcohol? It's like a freaking seance, you know? Yes. I think I do. I'm drunk. I mean, I got a quart of beer open in the truck. Yes, I got a problem with alcohol. And he says, welcome. Sit down. So I sat down. Pitch dark, right? Sit down in this deal. And we went around and talked. One of the ladies had a husband that was drinking. And so we talked about her husband's drinking and what she could possibly do to get him to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was my first AA meeting. Maybe a couple of the other ladies shared a little bit, you know. One little lady shared a little war story. She just got out of jail and was here. And oh, by the way, can you sign my court paper? And so it was like, and I'm sitting there thinking, well, this is great. You know, this is super. I finished my first AA meeting. Don't know any more about this than the man in the moon. You with us? Please come back. I will. walking down the stairs, you know, thinking, you know, when hell freezes over. I says, what was that about? I get drunk, I get in trouble, I go back to AA. And I'm trying these meetings and I'm showing up drunk. And I'm trying these meetings and I'm showing up sober. But I can't stay sober because when I go to the meetings, we're not talking about anything under the sun except, here it is, problems. You with me? And war stories. I work at a treatment center in Texas. I do clerical work for a treatment center. I'm not a therapist or a counselor. Alicia and I, we run a little store and we do follow-up calls to the alumni. One of our cool jobs is to help alcoholics and addicts get connected to the 12-step community after they leave treatment. Because we know when they get connected, they stay sober. When they don't get connected, they don't stay sober. Treatment centers don't crank out sober people. Treatment centers crank out dry people. Right? You with us? The spiritual experience is not taking place in treatment. It's going to take place out here. When we try to get them connected to good big book thumpers, trust me, if we get anybody from Denmark, I got a bunch of names that I can send people to here. Because a bunch of you cats would be great, great sponsors. You're down with that? But when these guys come to this hospital, first thing we do is we get a chance to love on them when they're down in SCU and they're hurting and feeling lousy. And we've seen this 1,000 times. They'll look up on the wall and they'll see the 12 steps and they'll go, oh no. You know, they just spent a huge chunk of money, committed to 30 days of their life to come into treatment, to find out that it's all about AA. With me? Because AA works. And we know that as a hospital, that's why we do it. You with us? But they are so disappointed when they get there. Because they've been to AA. And they had the same experience I had. It did not work. Because they never got to hear the truth. My experience was I sat in AA for 7 years, in and out of the fellowship, listening to you tell your stupid war stories. I'm sitting there listening to these people talk about war stories. Y'all understand, I'm pushing 31, 32 when I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not going to jail. I'm sitting in a meeting listening to this guy with first step meeting, you know? Let's tell Chris how we got here, you know? And it's, oh, you know, I had 6 DWIs and beat my wife and... not me. I'm smiling. Thank you. Oh, thank you for sharing from the heart like that. This guy's had 7 DWIs and he's been to prison, and he's a little geeky, but he's sharing his little story. Oh, thank you for sharing that. You know, we're going around and going around. And I've said this from a million podiums, folks. By the time it gets about halfway around the room, I realize what they're doing. They're all trying to one-upmanship. Oh, you think he's bad? I black out and piss my pants. Check, check, check. Not me. I can't relate. You see, we don't ever connect the war stories with the internal condition called the spiritual malady. You tell a war story like that to a 16-year-old kid who is a real alcoholic, they're not going to understand. They're not going to relate. They're going to wait till they start having DWIs before they can relate. We've got to stop that. We watch it. Women in AA die by the thousands because they come into these meetings and they listen to all these hairy-legged guys tell all their stupid drunkologues and their stupid war stories, believing that's what this thing is about. What we're trying to do is scare newcomers into, you don't want this to happen to you, do you? Oh, no. Then stay in AA. You with us? But the book says on page 24 in our textbook that you're not going to remember the consequences of a week or a month ago. You're not even going to remember your own war stories, much less my chicken shit stories. Listen, war stories have a place. It's called a 12-step call. Go down with that? Somebody that's never been around our fellowship, doesn't know anything about this drinking business, you can sit down at the cafeteria down here with him, sit there and eat something and visit with him a little bit, share some of your stories about how many times how you puke, projectile vomit or whatever, and get this guy's attention. You can talk about being arrested or whatever, maybe get some identification going, and then bring him to a meeting. But once he's to a meeting, why don't you can it with the war stories? We've made identification. We've got the cat to come in here. You understand this drinking. You understand about dope. I'm with you. This will work. Now we've got to get him in these rooms. Now we've got to start telling him something different. Watch these ladies come into meetings and we'll sit there at a new meeting and she's freaked out and she's uncomfortable. She doesn't want to really be there. And some stupid idiot wants to tell some story about eating out of dumpsters. She's a businesswoman. She's in a suit. She works. She's got 3 kids at home. Why do you want to tell her a stupid story about eating out of a dumpster? Are you looking for sympathy? Because it's not working. All you're doing is scaring her out of the room. There's a lot of people that come into our fellowship that have never eaten out of a dumpster. I don't happen to be one, but God dang it. If y'all pick up a copy of a big book of Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, y'all have it over here. It's conference approved literature. I'm sure a lot of you have it. There's an excerpt in there. It says in 1940, this cat writes this. There's an old timer in there. It says, "We did not tell our drinking histories in meetings back then. 1940. Book was published in 1939. This is very early days. We didn't need to. A man's sponsor already knew the details. Frankly, we did not think it anybody's business. We all knew how to drink. What we wanted and needed to know was how to how to get sober and stay sober. What a concept. This is why our success rates were so great back in the olden days of Alcoholics Anonymous, folks. You read the preface in the 1955, the second edition, you read the prefaces, it says we had a 75% success rate in this country. Right now in the United States, we hover around 8% in the United States. I'll argue those statistics with anybody. How did we take a perfectly wonderful fellowship and in 70 years trash it? You know how we did it? We turned our back. This fellowship turned their back and allowed it to take place. Somebody said the other day, well, treatment centers have caused... You're right. Treatment centers have done us a lot of damage. But who allowed it to happen?
We did.
When we finish with the war stories, we start this junior therapy session. Right? Our meetings in the United States, most of all of the open discussion meetings, which are the preponderance of meetings in our fellowship over there, it's like 90% to 10%. We have a few literature-based meetings and some speaker meetings, but most of our meetings are open discussion meetings. That means where you can come and talk about anything you want. You with us? And they usually start with this. They read how it works, then the chairperson says, well, this is your meeting. Who's got the problem? Spit me! I got the problem. And then we're going to spend an hour talking about that problem. It's not going to be a problem with a step. Y'all follow me? It's not going to be a problem with meditation, something that we could talk about. It's going to be a problem, something at home. And we're going to spend an hour talking about that. Now, folks, I got to tell you, I don't hit anything else from the podium harder than this. This has got to stop. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a therapy group. It is not a process group. Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual program of action. Early days, Ebby Thatcher, little guy, you know, Roland Hazard comes back from the continent and after working with Carl Jung and he drinks again and he's so depressed and Dr. Jung says you need to have a spiritual experience, and so he gets involved with the Oxford Movement in New York and they're doing work with street people, they're down in the missions and Roland has a spiritual experience, and he's one of the little guys he sees in there is a little guy named Ebby Thatcher. He takes him to his house and in 2 weeks he works him through the steps. Now, steps originally were 6 steps, and they exploded them. And Bill Wilson, you know, took a perfectly simple 6-step program and made it a 12-step program. Go figure. But in the 6-step, he worked Ebby through the steps. Ebby has a spiritual experience, and the obsession to drink leaves him. He eventually drank again, but long and short, he was sober at the time. About a few weeks sober, he gets on a bus and goes find a little cat named Bill Wilson, who was the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. He sits down with Bill Wilson and they share a few little war stories. They get comfortable visiting, old time sake, you know. And then Ebby tells him how he got sober. He found God. Bill Wilson gets more loaded that day, ends up back in treatment the next day. This was his third time in treatment at Towns Hospital. Third time. He left AMA the other 2 times against medical advice. He never stayed through the whole treatment. This time he was committed to stay through the whole treatment. Willing to go any length, folks? This time he stayed. While he was in treatment, Ebby worked the steps with him. It's in the book, guys. It's in the story. It's in the front of the book in Bill's story. He does a 4-step with him. Let's Bill share his stuff with him in a 5th step. He's working on his amends on his 9th day in Towns Hospital when he has his barn-burning spiritual experience. And the obsession to drink left and never returned. 6 months later, he's working with drunks. He's busting his butt. But what he's doing is he's going about it all wrong. He's just out there preaching. He ends up back in Akron fixing to drink. Crazy. Business deal went south. He knows he's shaky ground and needs to find another drunk to work with. So he goes find Dr. Bob. The story's in the book. Dr. Bob and him make it together. Dr. Bob was all settled. I'm going to meet with this moron in about 15 minutes and then he's out of here, you know? Because I don't want to talk to this guy. And they talked for hours. What did they talk about? They initially talked about war stories. They shared some commonality about their drinking. I've done that. I can relate to that. You with me? And then Bill told him how he got sober. Dr. Bob did everything except make amends and got drunk. June 10th. He had his last couple of drinks. He was doing surgery. He was a proctologist. I'm sure you may not know that. That's a butt doctor. I mean, that's exactly what it is. And then, I mean, this is great. This is our roots. An out-of-work stockbroker and a butt doctor. This guy's fixing to do surgery, and he's a little shaky. The guy figures he'd give him a couple of beers to steady his hands. After he drinks those beers, though, he does his surgery, gets in the truck, goes around Akron, and finishes making his amends that he had refused to make previously. Never to drink again for the next 15 years till he died. You're down with this? 2 days later, they say, it's time to go work, find another drunk. And they went to Towns Hospital and they found another drunk. And they did it the same every time. They shared some stories. They got the cat comfortable. Then they set the hook. They told him exactly what they did to get well. A spiritual program of action where we have to turn around and go work with another drunk to stay sober. About 1970, we had success rates through the ceiling. 50s, 60s, we were still being quite successful. Our fellowship was growing hugely. In that mid-70s, there was an article in the Grapevine called the Open Discussion Meeting, where the Grapevine, you know, our meeting in print, absolute rubbish. Absolute rubbish. Absolute rubbish. We have the meeting in print. It's called the Big Book. And you guys that are fans of the Grapevine, keep reading it. Great. Just keep them out of our meetings. We have enough distraction as it is. Unbelievable. The open discussion meeting. In the 1970s, the treatment center started cranking out drunk after drunk after drunk. And they'd tell them to go to these meetings and talk about their problems. If you're having a bad day, come share. Because if you share, you'll feel better. True. Isn't that the truth, guys? How many of you guys ever was drinking and you got real sick and you went to the bathroom and puked and you came back and you just felt so much better? Y'all ever do that? Isn't that what you do when you come into our meeting? You want to come in and talk about the stupid divorce one more time or talk about the kids or talk about the problem? Everybody loves on you and you just leave. I just feel so much better. Great. Well, let me ask you a question. What about the little kid in the back? What about the guy that came in after the meeting started and was sitting back there scared to death, can't even hold a coffee cup because he's detoxing in our meeting? Did we talk about the spiritual experience? Did we talk about the power of God? No, we didn't, because we were too busy trying to fix your little chicken shit problem. Guys, the book talks about this. We're here to give after the meeting, before the meeting. We're going to talk about all your problems if you want to. But during a meeting, Jesus, can't we just talk about the solution? That newcomer, this may be the one shot that the newcomer gets. Let's talk about the first step. Let's explain this to them. Am I speaking from some spiritual mountaintop up here? Absolutely not. Have I gone into meetings and dumped my problems? Absolutely. I'm just here to tell you I was wrong doing that. I'm making amends to the fellowship. I was wrong to do that. I used a format that was supposed to be spiritual in nature as a problem-solving event. We've got to stop it. Can you imagine how stupid this is? You cats are coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and want to talk to a collective room of probably some of the sickest people on earth about your relationships. What we absolutely need in our fellowship is more spiritual mentors. We need more spiritual mentors and a few less junior therapists. Yeah. I'm 7 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't get this. People want to come up after Chris, you just didn't want it. I just think that's the most disrespectful thing we can say. You know, for an alcoholic to screw up his strength and walk into a strange room full of people, you with us, and admit they're an alcoholic, you can't sit there and tell me he didn't want it. The truth is, there's a lot of us that wanted it and never heard the solution. We heard, keep coming back. It works if you work it. We heard 90 meetings in 90 days. You with us? We didn't hear, work the damn steps or you're going to die. But that's what they heard in the olden days. Fast forward, 1987. I'm coming apart at the seams. Health is going south. I'm working for Myers in the bindery, and I can't cook anymore. I'm too sick, and hands are too shaky. And let me see if you can relate to this. I can't sleep. I'm waking up in the middle of the night, and the voices are there screaming, "Shit! You know, you're worthless. You're never going to amount to anything." I'm 35 years old and I have no money. And if it wasn't for family, I'd be on the street. And life is not exactly turning out like I had envisioned it to be. I'm dating a girl that's... I'm not dating anyone. In my head, I think I'm dating someone, but I'm not. Just like I'm dating the coffee girl. So, anyway, I was pulling out of a store one day, and I've talked about this before. I was pulling out of a store, a grocery store, one day out on the street, and I take a left to go to work to the bindery and take a right to go back to my apartment. And I get to the stop sign, and I've got to make a decision what I'm going to do. And it's like I vapor lock. You know, I need to go to work because I need to earn some money, but I'm so uncomfortable in my skin, I need to go back home. I just want to go hide, you know, curl into a fetal position under the bed, you know, leave me alone, you know. I'm psychotic. I'm nuts. I sit there in that Kroger parking lot there on 121 and have a nervous breakdown. It's like, Chris, this is not some analytical problem here. Turn left, turn right, but get out of the goddamn intersection, you know? And I can't do anything. I've got cars honking behind me, and this is a terrible place to be. It's getting worse. I'm crazy. I can't get comfortable in my skin. The depression's killing me. I'm taking all these pills to try to treat it, and they're not working. And the alcohol's not working, and the cocaine's not working. I drove home after work one Thursday night. Went up to my apartment, had a stack of return checks in the mail, and cold up in North Texas. Not Denmark cold, but cold. And I sat in my little apartment. There was no furniture in there. I'm sitting on the floor. I owned two ferrets, stink ferrets. And I turned the kitchen light on and opened the checks, and you know, I've exhausted another bank account, and I know I can go to Myers and get it. You know, how tired do you get going to your family asking them to bail you out again? You know, without much fanfare or thought, I walked to my little balcony. I had a little balcony there, and I looked outside, and there's a food line over there, and they're selling Christmas trees. It's November, it's holiday season, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, and I don't have any money for Christmas either. And nobody's getting gifts for me one more time this year. And I walked to the medicine cabinet and I opened it up and I got a couple of bottles of pills out. Lots of pills. Doctors have been giving them to me for years for my nervous disposition. And but I like to go fast, so I'm stocking pile of the downers. And I took a handful of pills and washed them down with alcohol. It's like, guys, I've said it from a million podiums. There's nothing in me that wanted to die. Y'all understand? There's nothing romantic about suicide. I just did not want to live feeling the way I was feeling. That feeling of uselessness, folks, is absolutely devastating. And we've got people in this room right now that are 15 years old that are feeling that way. We've got people in here that are 80 years old that are feeling that way. That is not normal. There's nothing romantic about taking your life and letting somebody else clean up the mess. Selfish and self-centeredness is the root of the problem. That's selfish and self-centeredness on steroids. Y'all understand that? Don't do it, because it's not an answer. I heard a voice that night as I sat down on the edge of the bed. I heard a voice that said, "Chris, don't do this. Go back to AA." And I said, "I'm not ever going back to AA." "Chris, don't do this. Go back to AA." I don't know where the voice was coming from, folks. I remember looking under the bed, seeing if anybody was in the apartment with me. The voice was here. "Chris, don't do it. Go back to AA. I hate AA. If I have to sit in another meeting and listen to you tell your little war stories and piss and moan about your chicken shit day, I'm going to go crazy. I'd rather be dead. Chris, don't do it. Go back to AA." Scared, hair standing up on my arms. Go to the bathroom, make myself sick. The next morning, the voice is still there. I'm hung over like a big dog. "Chris, don't do it. Go back to AA." I went to work. I left at lunch. Went to a doctor. Got some doggy downers to try to detox. And at 6 o'clock that night, I walked in the back door of an AA meeting in Louisville, Texas. The difference was I'd never been to this meeting. Somebody had showed it to me. And I walked in the back door, and there was about 40 people in there, and they were all smoking. You know, it was back in the days when you could smoke in a meeting, you know, and the ceiling dropping down. And they were all carrying big books, folks. They were all carrying big books. And I remember thinking as I walked in, I said, "Shit." I said, "Of all the meetings I can go to, you know, I've got to go to a little big book thumper conclave here, you know." And I remember trying to back out, and some little girl snagged me and by the belt loop, set me down in a chair, and says, "Meet's fixing to start. So you can leave after this is over." And I said, "Oh, shit." I busted. And they set a cup of coffee down in front of me, you know, plastic styrofoam cup, coffee, hotter than hell, you know, and I'm a little quick, you know, and it's... They laugh. I'll never forget it. Some girl laughed. And set a roll of paper towels down next to me so I could clean up my mess. And I just am a mess. And I'm self-conscious, and I'm always, you know... I remember when drinking was great. I was the John Travolta, but now it's just my patch is almost perpetually on crooked, you know. And I'm, you know, I look like shit, The chairperson had seen me up in North Texas before, and he said, "Chris has been around this fellowship a long time, folks, and I'm sure he's going to pick up a desire chip tonight. Let's share some hope with this guy, shall we? Let's don't share any war stories tonight. Let's share. He knows." Let's share some hope. And they went around the room and they shared some stories, little vignettes, short stories, for it, no long-winded stuff, short, so I could understand. I'm not hitting on, you know, arcing, you know, little head, just. I'm detoxing. They shared stories about getting relationships back. They talked about getting a credit card back. I had a credit card one time. Until I maxed it out and they took it back. And so and they talked about getting their credit back, and they talked about buying a car. Now I'm in an old truck that's I spent $600 for, you know. But I don't have a spare, and I don't have any insurance, and the tags are expired. You'll follow me? And it's like, it's illegal. And I'm sitting there thinking, here's a guy that's not drinking, and he's got tags, you know, license, spare tire, everything he needs to be legal, you know? It's like, but this is stuff that I could sink my teeth into, you know? They weren't talking about coming into this fellowship and becoming little sunbeams for Jesus. They were talking about stuff that I could sink my teeth into, that I understood. Jesus. At the end of the meeting, the old timer asked me if I wanted to stay sober for good and for all. Dr. Bob's story, they talk about it. "Chris, are you ready to stay sober for good and for all?" And I said, "Well, you know, one day at a time." That statement has probably killed more alcoholics than anything else. Because this book doesn't say we stay sober one day at a time. It says we have a daily reprieve based on a commitment to finish this work. I live life one day at a time. Make a commitment that I want to stay sober today. That's great, because everything's going great. I'm surrounded by great friends. I've got a nice wife. Everything's good. I've got a good job. But what happens if I go home and my wife gets killed, or I lose my job? If I'm depending on willpower to keep me sober today, I'm going to get drunk. Folks, I must have the spiritual experience so that the obsession to drink leaves. Are y'all down with that? This is what happened to me. They asked me that question. I said one day at a time. They looked at me with much displeasure. They were not looking for that answer. They explained to me how arrogant I was, and I thought that I could self-will myself into this, and they left the room. And I followed them. I said, ask me again. I did. Chris, do you want to stay sober for the rest of your life? Are you ready to make a commitment that you're going to do this deal? I said, yes. And the old guy hugged me. Gary Davis and Smith and... I hug my neck and he says, we're going to do this. You come back in the morning. And they were there on my front porch the next morning. Make sure I got up and got to that meeting at 10 o'clock. Went to an AA meeting. After the meeting, they sat down and they showed me the circle triangle in the book and they explained the physical allergy, the mental obsession, and the spiritual malady. And we went in the next room, got on our knees and did a third step prayer where I asked God to be my father. We went and got some Mexican food, and on the way back, they started talking to me about my fourth step. 2 days in the fellowship, and we're working fourth step. Too fast? Guys, those people knew I was dying. Those people, for the first time, loved me enough to tell me the truth. They didn't give a rat's ass if they hurt my feelings or not. They didn't. They weren't there for my comfort. They were there to show me what real love is. And I got to tell you something, folks. I've had a couple of conversations with some of you, and you guys want to get this idea that what we're talking about is very intolerant. I want to tell you, sometimes looking the other way is not love. That old phrase, you know, at what point does live and let live become apathy? Yeah. Let him have his own experience. Great. I've watched you moms and dads in here taking care of your kids. I sat back there last night and sat there and watched one of the guys sit there and love on his little baby like that, you know? The little kid started heading towards the elevator. The doors are opening. What is it? Let him have his own experience. No? Did you hear it? He grabbed the little kid back. What did the little kid do? Started wailing. The little kid wanted to go in the elevator. Dad didn't want him to go to the elevator. You with us? That's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We keep each other from heading the elevator. I'm in a meeting every night, and every night we're talking about a step, and every night we're working with newcomers, and they've got me busy working with newcomers right off the bat. I haven't even done a four-step yet. 2 weeks into this, I've got a completed four-step, and I need to tell you, I drove home to North Texas up to that little apartment where I tried to commit suicide, and I pulled up in the parking lot and pulled the tailgate down in my truck. It's after a 6 o'clock meeting. It's like 8:30, and I'm feeling... different. And I pull the tailgate down on that old truck and big crystal clear sky and big old full moon up there and see my breath. And I look around and realize that I'm surrounded by liquor. 7-Eleven, Stop and Go, Circle K, you know, liquor stores. Bar where I got a tab. Cocaine dealer in the apartment complex where I live. Friday, pocket full of money. I don't want to use. The desire to use has been lifted. 1 minute I can't stop thinking about alcohol and dope, and the next minute it's gone. I'm 17 years sober, and it's never returned. Guys, that's the greatest news I can tell you. I recovered from alcoholism 2 weeks into this deal. I recovered from alcoholism. And we sit in treatment centers and listen to people kill people, tell them they're always going to be in recovery. You're always going to be recovering. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Why don't you finish the goddamn steps and then you can recover and everything will be cool. How's that? We've got an industry out there called the treatment center industry that wants to keep us sick. Every time you go back to treatment, you spend some more money. Y'all understand that? We are sick people. We are sick people. Relapse is a part of this. Just expect it. No, that's not what this book says. I recovered. One of the reasons I recovered is those men and women in that room loved me enough to tell me what I needed to do to stay sober. And one of those things that I hadn't done for 7 years was work with others. And they had me actively working with others. The first weekend I was in there, they had me answering the phones in the group. Y'all, there's a little phone room, pay phone on the wall. And they said, Chris, we're going to go into this meeting. Could you stay out here and answer the phone? No. Don't you know me? I'm the newcomer. I'm the most important person here. No, you're 7 years around this program relapsing like a son of a bitch. You are not a newcomer. You've been around. You know what to do. We need some help answering the phones. He said, Chris, you've been this guy, right in my face. Look over these little glasses. Looks, Chris, you've been a taker all your life. In order to get well, you're going to have to start becoming a giver.
All right.
You're going to have to go out of your way. He said, just answer the phone. I said, buddy, I don't know how to answer the phone. You know, he's looking at me like, what? He says, Chris, if somebody's calling, they're just looking for meeting schedules usually, or what times the meetings are. The schedules are right there. We got a guy out here. Is he going to stand here and help you if you get in over your head? We're not expecting you to save somebody's soul on the phone, for heaven's sakes. Just answer the damn thing if it rings. You with us? He turns around and starts to walk away, and the phone rings. And I'm schlocked. I'm just... No. Screw you. You know, I don't feel comfortable doing this. I'm detoxing, for heaven's sakes. I mean, I don't... And he just turns around and looks. Phone's ringing. I said, shit. What do I do? He says, answer the... Say, Louisville Group. Oh, shit. How embarrassing. Louisville Group. It's an Al-Anon lady. She wants an Al-Anon meeting. My first 12-step call is going to be an Al-Anon lady. And I'm talking to this lady. I said, yeah, we got a meeting right after this meeting. It's such and such a time. I says, and I recognize her voice. I used to drink with her husband. Now, come on, guys. You're talking about spiritual intervention here. I'm feeling uncomfortable about this. And I know this woman that I'm talking to on the phone. And she is blessed because I'm there. Because she... Oh, Chris, is that you? Are you... You're getting sober? And it's like, if God damn, if you can do it, he can do it, you know? I says, buddy, I'll wait for you out front, you know? And I stood out after the meeting and I waited for her up front. She got there and I showed her where the Al-Anon room was and introduced her to some of the ladies that I just met and went back outside. But the difference was this. Instantly, what happened? I walked back out in the phone room and it wasn't this, you know, I'm looking around like a little scared rabbit. So it was, I walked back into... my phone room. You understand? I was no longer monitoring AA. You know, I was no longer visiting this group. This was my group. This is my phone. I mean, they created a monster. For the next 6 months, you couldn't go near that phone. Phone and ring, some little newcomer get up there and start to answer. And I said, oh, no. This is very important. You could kill somebody on this phone. They created a monster. And they immediately had me go into 12 steps, you know, to the treatment centers to carry a little message, H&Is. I couldn't share much, folks. I couldn't even put two sentences together without slurring my words. I was a mess. But they let me come carry the books. They let me come and participate. And because they allowed me to become a part of that group, I stayed. And that's what I'm saying in this, to end this talk, this diatribe. If you don't find a job in AA, you're not going to stay. If you're always on the periphery, you'll never come into the center of the fold. We expect the newcomer to come in and just get, you know, ask themselves to coffee. Of course, they're not going to do that. They're scared to death. They don't know what to ask. They don't know what a big book is. They don't know what's protocol, what's okay and what's not okay. They don't know that they can't share their problems. You've got to tell them they can't share their problems. Come before the meeting. Well, let's talk about that. But during the meeting, let's talk about some miracles. Is your life today better as a result of working the steps? Yeah, you can't believe what happened this morning. Oh, share that in the meeting. You'll change their life. Book says on page 17 that we've got a common solution. It says we've got a common problem. There's one element of the cement that binds us together. But that is not going to hold us together as this common solution is. It's a common solution that holds us together. What's the common solution?
The spiritual experience.
Guaranteed as a result of working the 12 steps. Folks, you can work the steps. You can take as long as you want to work those steps. Yesterday, we left some of you with the impression that this was a race. But I believe it is a race up to a certain point. You know, because if the obsession to use returns, we're going to go use again. And all the wailing and gnashing of teeth are not going to stop us from doing that. Become a part of this fellowship. I don't know about Denmark. It looks to me like you guys are alive and well and doing wonderful here. In the United States, our fellowship is in the toilet. Our fellowship is in the toilet. I've got some other Americans in here that can attest to this. The message has been so watered down. We're so politically correct now, we won't talk about God in meetings. Treatment centers that are state-funded can no longer talk about God in their meetings. You follow us? Because of the separation of church and state. We have this problem now. We can't do that. And so what's taking place is there are a lot of people coming out of treatments that are not staying sober. And they're coming into our fellowships. And folks, if we're not armed with the facts about ourselves, if we're not ready to take on the responsibility, they're going to die. Before I leave you, can you get your little mind around that? If Thursday night, there's a great television show on, but it's also your home group meeting. And you know, last Thursday night there was a lady that was there, and she was looking at you and listening to what you had to say, and she's freaked out and scared and she didn't know, but she's been thinking all week long about asking you to sponsor, right? She's been thinking about talking to you about this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. But you've made a decision to stay home that night because maybe the husband decides that it's time that you spend a little more time with the kids. It's time we got a little balance in our lives. Screw balance. It's time that we understood what we were supposed to be doing on this earth, and that is being servants to God's kids. That's basic spiritual principle. We are all servants. We are put here to serve. On committees, one-on-one, pouring coffee, cleaning toilet, whatever it is that's going to make this message easier to transmit is what we're supposed to be doing. And sometimes God asks us, a lot of us. Maybe He knows that we can buck it up and take the pressure. My mom asked me one time, not long ago, she said, Chris, 17 years, you've been sober a long time. How much longer are you going to have to go to those A&A meetings? You know? See, my mom didn't know about the first, second, or third suicide attempt. My mom doesn't know about me eating out of dumpsters in Houston, Texas. My mom doesn't know about the times I would drive down the road and hear voices. She didn't know about the extended liver, the compromised health, the line of hurt people behind me. She didn't know about the busted up dreams that I never was going to be able to have because of one thing, alcoholism. She doesn't understand that my life depends on constant work with others. It depends on being in a room with other people that understand who I am to help me stay on this path. What a legacy we've been given. 70 years ago, folks, we died in insane asylums. And 70 years down the road, this is still the only game in town. There's no pill to fix us. No therapy to fix us. No vitamin regime to fix us. this God of our own understanding, the spiritual experience is guaranteed as you do the work. I want every one of you. Bad news, even when the bad eye cries. Bless your hearts. I hope 20 years from now I stroke out from the podium. You know, I hope, what a way to go, to be in a room full of alcoholics and little dope fiends. And if any of you guys ever come to the States, you know, we've been passing out business cards and emails and stuff. We'd love to hear from you guys. If you ever get to the States, we'll hook you up with some good meetings wherever you're coming from. And gosh, if you ever get to the Hill Country, come see our where we live. And would so love to stay in touch with you. For every one of you cats that have been sober for a few years, that are in the trenches still, carrying the message, walking into meetings with books, I want to tell you, thanks. Thanks. Thanks for standing for something. Thanks for not getting pushed over and bowled over trying to be politically correct. Thanks for knowing that this is about God. Thanks for knowing I was coming. Because I got a pretty cool life today because of it. I'll see y'all later. Thanks.